So good morning. I feel quite honored to be here, and I'm delighted to welcome any visitors to our church this morning. The title of the sermon is called Breathing Room, and I came upon that because I'm just recovering from a bout of pneumonia. If you've ever had a respiratory illness, that experience of gasping for breath, something that when you're well is a normal everyday occurrence, suddenly makes that simple act profound. One afternoon in my recovery, I sat in the backyard. It was a beautiful spring day. There were 19 geese that had landed on the pond. Two turtles sunned themselves on the water's edge, and my first bumblebee of the season brushed past my cheek. Although my chest felt tight as I relaxed in the beauty of that afternoon, I soon found myself filled with the sweetness of the day. I could feel my fret loosen, the tightness of this long winter finally releasing its grip. It was so freeing to dip into that inner stillness, to feel sunlight warming my face, to hear the wind stirring trees, to notice my heartbeat, to deeply sense life around me. In the process, I realized something I had not known. I had been holding my breath for a really long time. Maybe I hadn't really breathed since my father died back in December. Grief has a way of doing that to us, constricting us, turning us inward with our pain. Only I had not realized, had not felt that clench so viscerally as I did that afternoon. That irony is not lost on me, that it took me gasping for breath to recognize that my spirit had been choking in some regards as well. It wasn't only my lungs that needed breathing room, it was my life. Maybe you've been there too. Those times when our life seems to narrow, when we find ourselves holding ourselves in, numb with fear, loss, hurt, presenting a brave but false face to the world and to ourselves. The poet Rilke, in his book Love Poems to God, understands this experience quite well. He writes, "No one lives his life. Disguised since childhood, haphazardly assembled from voices and fears and little pleasures, we come of age, ask masks. Our true face never speaks. Somewhere there must be storehouses where all these lives are laid away, like suits of armor or old carriages or clothes hanging simply on the walls. Maybe all paths lead there to the repository of unlived things." If you've ever poked around in an old attic, you know that smell of age, the dust motes, and how time itself can seem suspended in such places, as if time has held its breath. You think, who lived here? What mattered to them? And what is left of their lives? A great sadness even can come upon us, same as when we find an old letter, visit a family gravesite, or come upon a gray shoe in the Holocaust Museum that lost its wearer to that dark angel of history. Yet none of us wants to imagine our lives discarded in a storeroom, or to find in the end that the life we have lived has been false. Lest all this seems too dreary, though, in the next poem, Rilke offers this insight. "And yet, though we strain against the deadening grip of daily necessity, I sense there is this mystery. All life is being lived. Who is living it then? Is it the things themselves or something waiting inside them like an unplayed melody in a flute? Is it the wind blowing over the waters? Is it the branches that signal to each other? Is it flowers interweaving their fragrances on streets as they wind through time? Is it the animals warmly moving, or the birds that suddenly rise up? Who lives it then? God, are you the one who is living life? I find myself thunderstruck by that question. God, are you the one living life? Because if it is true, I want to know that God life living and flowing through me. So I believe that today's scripture from Mark 12 can give us a clue. How can this possibly happen for us? You have to stop thinking when you think about this passage and put it in context, that this is part of a larger conversation Jesus has been having with the scribes and Pharisees, the religious leaders and scholars of the day. They've already posed two prior challenges to him. Should faithful Jews pay taxes to Caesar or not? And then they ask about the woman who married seven times, whose seven husbands all died before her. Whose husband will she? Who will get to be her husband in heaven? Clearly, these concerns are formed out of what I would call a dualistic mindset. A dualistic mindset loves those forced choice questions. It demands things to be this way or that way. If you've ever experienced them, you'll know that dualistic questions always feel like a trap, because they are. If you answer within the logic of the question itself, at least, you are doomed. A classic example is, have you stopped beating your wife? Well, if you say yes, it implies that you used to beat her. If you say no, it implies that you are still a brute. Either way, it's not looking too good. Jesus, in this situation, has just answered these two imponderables. In both cases, he astonished his hearers by reframing their questions entirely, thereby revealing the issues themselves to be spurious. His replies reveal their thinking is just too shallow, their understanding of God too narrow, and their preoccupations off the mark. But they still ask one more question, that kicker. Jesus, which commandment is most important? Okay, here's another clue about dualistic thinking. It really likes to rank things. It likes calculations. It likes to set up hierarchies. It wants to know who or what is better. Now that works with things like first aid, when you need to know, do you attend to the breathing first or the breath? But when you're thinking about eternal matters, like putting God's covenant law under that lens, the flaw is really obvious. It's like asking the sea if it has a favorite fish, if the night its favorite star, the earth its most beloved plant, or the artist her one perfect beauty. We can never be sure entirely what his hearers were expecting, but again, Jesus sidesteps the false dichotomy and reframes the conversation. What is first? What is best? His answer makes it clear that it is starting from relationship, and that what illumines and governs all else is love. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Instead of hierarchies or rules or pat answers, clever analysis, Jesus redirects us to the centrality of a loving and trusting relationship with our Creator. What is most important? Encounter God with your full self, heart, soul, strength, and mind. Encounter one another with the same. Meet the other with heart, that which stirs our emotions and desires, elicits tenderness, compassion, and courage. Connect on the soul level, that deepest part of us which reflects the divine image and mirrors the eternal. Engage with all of your strength, intention, effort, perseverance, commitment, vigor. Seek to know the beloved with a whole mind, both your intellect and reason, but also through the mind's other gifts of intuition, imagination, curiosity, and wonder. Philosophers and theologians have long loved to argue the finer points of theology and philosophy and morality, and they will lob arguments across the ping pong ball of endless intellectual discourse. Let them. These conversations can be interesting and useful, and after all, faith is never anti-intellectual. Allow your questions and your queries to flow, and wrestle honestly with whatever you don't understand. God is wise enough and patient to stay with us through that process. But I also think Jesus is asking us to not limit our understanding of life in God to such thin aspects of relationship, to just what our emotions dictate, or to the limits of our personal experience, or to only what our rationality can understand or science can yet describe. Especially, we are asked not to limit our encounter with God to what dualistic thinking can comprehend. Science can explain the mechanics of my heartbeat, and dualism can let me know if it's a good idea for me to speed when the patrol car is behind me on the highway. But these can never plumb the depths of human hope or grief or beauty. They can never explain why my heart lifts particularly for you, or why you might even give up your life for me. Loving encounter is where God is living life in this vast and miraculous world. And I found that just as my lungs had more capacity than I had been using for quite a while, I believe our soul's capacity for divine love is large and many, many chambered. We are capable of deep, deep inhalations. Breathe it in. Faith, trust, connection, sacrifice, humility, gratitude, grace. Best of all, we do not have to earn any of this. It is already given. To the dualistic mind, a mandate to love God and our neighbors unreservedly can seem simply a mandate, another rule, another something to pile on that dead stuff that is destined for Rilke's storehouse. But if you hear these words from the perspective of divine encounter, this commandment becomes a vibrant and life-giving invitation. It promises that those who respond will find themselves planted like trees by streams of water, which yield fruit in season, whose leaves do not wither, and that we might prosper In those places in our lives where we have been lost, where our life force feels it has bled away from us, when we have felt masked or false, the good news is that the mystery of God's life still stirs. We too can sense this, as Rilke did, because mystery isn't an abstract idea or a philosophy. It is, in fact, a person we are summoned to know, a relationship in which we are pursued by a lover ardent for our yes. My prayer is that this morning's service may help us become that melody in Rilke's flute, and that we allow ourselves to be sung. May we relinquish our dualistic demands on reality and allow breathing room for faith. By God's grace, let us quiet ourselves until, despite voices, fears, all those things that derail us and send us to those dark storerooms and the bleak wildernesses in which we feel so often lost, even forsaken, may we sense God's life living within us again. When that happens, then I believe it is, as theologian Frederick Buechner explains, we will come to see this commandment to love God and our neighbor for what it truly is. It's less a command than a promise. That promise is that yes, on the weary wings of faith and the fragile feet of hope, we will come to love God as from the first God has always loved us. May the one who is living life stay as close to you as your very breath. And blessed be all the holy names of God.